The plebeians had to use force to tear supreme power from the hands of its previous possessors. The Greeks learned from their own experience that democracy originated through direct action by the people and could be maintained only by unrelaxed vigilance against the enemies of the people's rulership and rights. What were the basic social forces required to initiate and carry through the struggle for democracy at that time? These came out of the mercantile, manufacturing, maritime, and monetary economy. Heading these movements were energetic, ambitious, class-conscious merchants, sometimes of patrician origin, enriched by overseas trade, who felt that their business enterprises and urban advancement were being thwarted by the supremacy of the hereditary landowners or the special interests of the tyranny. Mobilized behind them were artisans, smaller tradesmen, and maritime workers. And here in parenthesis, for those of you who are or have been maritime workers, I'd like to say a little something about your breed. Since the time of the Greeks, waterfront workers and sailors have supplied shock troops for revolutionary combats of a democratic character in all the maritime centers and states. It was so in our own American Revolution. Coming from Boston, I know who the original forces of the Liberty Boys were, and they came out of the crews and out of the waterfront workers and the shipbuilders of that maritime city. Well, I can't go into that at length, but it's been an interesting sidelight of revolutionary democratic history. These city classes won backing from the poorer peasants, shepherds, and miners in the country districts. Now, in the cities, there were also foreigners, women, and slaves. They were shut out from the arena of political action, although sometimes they lent weight to the democratic side. Thus, the first democratic movements were based on a coalition of the commercial middle classes with the plebeians of the city and the countryside. The scores of democratic republics were best typified by Athens, the rival of Sparta, and its opposite in economic and political development. In the 5th century, Athens was comparable, let us say, to the United States today. It was the foremost commercial, naval, and cultural power in the Mediterranean area. Athens had passed through a monarchy, an aristocracy, a plutocracy, and an oligarchy before arriving at its democratic apogee. The city-state had originally been ruled by tribal kings, who were ousted by an aristocracy of noble landowners. Their sovereignty, in turn, was supplanted by a plutocracy and a tyranny. As early as 570, according to Aristotle, its people were divided into three political groupings. They had what is known as a three-party system. Although these were not formally organized parties in the modern sense, but loose amalgamations of elements which tended to combine against opponents on basic issues of concern to Athenian citizens. One was the coast party, led by the merchants, which aimed at a moderate middle-class republic. The second was the plains party, based on the large landholders in the best farming districts, who wanted an oligarchy dominated by a few noble families and rich men. The third and the most radical was the Hill Party, which mobilized artisans and small shopkeepers, indigent peasants, miners, and shepherds behind the more progressive merchants and manufacturers. This last grouping was the main driving force behind the democratic cause. Their incessant conflicts from 570 on with the entrenched oligarchic reaction eventually culminated in victory for the people. They created a democratic republic, the first in the world. It was the historical forerunner of all the subsequent democracies in the Western world. In social terms, what was the democratic revolution at that time? It consisted in the transfer of supremacy from the landed gentry and the few rich to the citizen body headed by the middle classes. The democratic institutions of Athens were perfected under Pericles. How many here have heard about Pericles? Okay, well, I see he's not unfamiliar. He was the illustrious statesman who directed the state for almost 30 years, from 467 to 427. Athens was a republic administered by elected magistrates and military leaders. It didn't have any single top executive, like a mayor, a governor, or a president. Do you know that the Athenians, who are more democratic-minded than we are, would have considered the exorbitant powers of the U.S. presidency as dangerously autocratic? And they would never permit the power of life and death to be placed in the hands of a single man. Never. Because they really practiced democracy. That the decisions of life and death had to be decided by all the people getting together and discussing it and taking a vote. The legislative functions were carried out by three agencies: the assembly, the council of 500, and the so-called prytany, composed of 10 committees of 50 members. The two latter served and were subordinate to the assembly. This was the basic governing body, which met four times a month. Formally, all freemen were on an equal footing, whether they lived in the city or the country, whether or not they had property, whether they were rich or born, rich or poor, high or low born. Every citizen belonged to the assembly, was supposed to attend its sessions and participate in its deliberations. The equalitarianism of this democracy was evidenced by the fact that every citizen could become an office holder. These were chosen by lot and often by rotation. This popular assembly had the final say on all important matters. It chose the administrative officials and had the right to judge and punish them. Athens had a citizen army and navy. Every freeman had the right, as well as the responsibility, of serving in the armed forces, and in case of war, being conscripted up to the age of 60. Athens didn't have a full-time standing army, which has been an ever-present threat to all democracies to date. You've been reading this spate of books, 7 Days in May, which talk about the threat to our democracy from our present military outfit. Well, the Greeks were well aware of this kind of threat to democracy. Their judiciary, too, was completely democratized. There were no professional judges or lawyers. The lawyer is an inheritance from the Middle Ages and the beginning of the bourgeois period. Cases were decided by juries of citizens on which any citizen could serve and which sometimes numbered in the several hundreds. Their verdicts were given by secret ballot. From the time of Pericles, state officials, jurors, and in part even military men were paid for their services. This enabled the poorer people to shoulder the functions of government. And they had another safeguard against reversion to tyranny. No doubt you've heard about it. It was called ostracism. Any individual who was thought to threaten the security or stability of the state could be exiled for 10 years through a resolution backed by 6,000 ballots cast in the assembly. We ostracize people, we place the decision for that in the executive branch. Under this system, democracy flowered in Athens. Its citizens enjoyed a free atmosphere of public discussion and lively debate on all problems of foreign and domestic policy and on all public personalities. They provided a model for all Greece, which has been admired from that time to this. The Athenians were perhaps, certainly they were one of the most remarkable groups of people that have ever existed on this planet. Perhaps we might even say the most remarkable up to date from the standpoint of what they have created, which survived. They were very keen-witted individuals in the mass. However, this pioneer experiment in popular government had serious shortcomings. First, women, although half the population, had no place whatsoever in public life. The wives of citizens had a lower status than women in Mohammedan countries today. Second, citizenship was an hereditary privilege. Foreigners and strangers who settled in Athens, even from another Greek city, had no citizenship rights and could be sent away at any time. And some of the most illustrious citizens of Greece, if they got crossways with the Athenians, met that fate. Third, the slaves who belonged to the freemen and sustained the urban economy were barred from politics. Roughly calculating, 2/3 or more of the 300,000 inhabitants of Athens were excluded from participation in its administration. Scientifically speaking, Athens was a slave democracy. Now, this combination may appear paradoxical or impossible to you. It shouldn't, because you have studied about it in American history. The pre-Civil War South in our own country was a slave democracy. It set a formally democratic superstructure on a slave foundation, didn't it? The Greeks might have had a word for it, but we once had the thing itself as well. Even apart from the disfranchisement of the women, foreigners, and slaves who made up most of the population, Athenian democracy was restricted in other ways within the precincts of its citizen body. The wealthier elements, the notables and aristocrats, contrived by one means or another to determine the main lines of policy. Behind the forms of majority rule, a minority became the main policy makers. I'd like to give you some of the reasons why. Only a few could read and write. The experienced leaders, skilled orators, and literate members of the upper classes could put many things over many times on the illiterate mechanics. Moreover, the city dwellers held the upper hand over the country folk. That's almost always been the case. All meetings of the assembly were held within the city, where it was easier for the townsfolk to be present. The cultivators had to tend their crops and couldn't easily get into the city for the sessions. Athens, if some of you have been there, was divided into three sectors. The city itself, its seaport, Piraeus, about 5 miles from the center, which was connected with the city by a wall. These were surrounded by the country district, settled by farmers, herdsmen, and miners. Finally, Athens was the paramount commercial, manufacturing, diplomatic, and naval power of the Mediterranean, active over a good part of the civilized and uncivilized world of the times. It was the first great city-state which was not economically self-sufficient. Grain was the principal article of its food supply. It had to be imported from the Black Sea region. Like Great Britain at the height of its empire, and even today, Athens found it absolutely indispensable to protect its lifelines of transport and communications to the Black Sea through the Strait of Bosphorus. The whole course of Athenian policy, including its major military and naval engagements, was determined by the need to safeguard its supremacy in the eastern Mediterranean. Thus, its domestic democracy was counterbalanced by its imperialist aims and activities. Athens subjected other cities and other city-states to itself and exacted heavy tribute from them. These conquered populations had the habit, as subject peoples will, of rebelling from time to time, especially when they were aided and encouraged by such rivals of Athens as the Persians, Spartans, and Corinthians. The uprisings of these subject cities of Athens were savagely crushed. You can read about that in a history like that of Thucydides, his History of the Peloponnesian War, the greatest work on history and antiquity. He was a citizen of Athens, even a general. I think there's an important lesson to be derived from this, especially important for contemporary Americans, because there's a link between democratic Athens and the democratic United States of America. The most democratic imperialism can resort to the harshest measures in order to defend its material and strategic interests. Take a look at South Vietnam as an illustration. The Athenians were the most cultured and civilized people of the ancient world. Yet their leaders did not shrink from wiping out every inhabitant in rebellious cities of 25,000 people. Why? Athens derived a good part of its wealth from plundering its vassals. And it would refrain from not even the bloodiest means in order to maintain its power and its privileged positions. I've called your attention to these imperfections, not to low rate or downgrade Athenian democracy, but simply to give you a rounded picture. With all the imperfections I've noted, the imperial slave state of Athens was a genuine democracy. Every Athenian citizen knew it and was proud of his freedom and equality. When he would go about, he would say to himself and proudly to others, especially in Macedonia, in Persia, in Egypt, in Italy, "I'm an Athenian, Now, what did it mean to be an Athenian in those days? He was not a subject. He was not a bondsman, but a dignified member of the Athenian democracy. Every social and political institution has to be appraised according to its specific position in history and the inescapable circumstances of its time. Athenian democracy should not be unfavorably contrasted or condemned by reference to some ideal democracy that never was on land or sea. It must be judged in comparison with what came before it and what prevailed around it. Just as Cuba today can't be judged according to some ideal socialist democracy, but by what came before it and what prevails around it. In the context of existing civilization, it was the broadest and freest form of government then known to man. Now, I'd like to contrast Athenian democracy with the parliamentary democracy of modern capitalism. They differed in three main respects. Athenian democracy was not the government of a nation, but of a city-state, small in territory, population, and active citizens. Athens measured a little over 1,000 square miles in extent. It could be tucked into a corner of California. Under Pericles, it had a population of about 400,000, of which no more than 43,000 were citizens. As you know, there are many cities in California that have more citizens than that. Athenian democracy, however, was direct. Its proportions offered certain advantages. The citizens could participate personally and continuously in the assembly, the law courts, and the armed forces. A person who didn't fully share in the government was, in Aristotle's eyes, not a citizen at all. The machinery of the government was in the hands of the people themselves as an everyday affair. The legislative functions were not carried out by elected and uncontrolled representatives, off in Sacramento or in Washington. The judicial functions weren't carried out by judges nominated for life. The administration wasn't carried on by bureaucrats, or the defense of the state by an officer caste or a standing army. The republic was not burdened by the permanent officialdom common to Asiatic despotisms before that time or to the empires which succeeded it. Was not administered by the extensive parasitic bureaucracies which infest contemporary states, permanent office holders who are deaf to the demands and the needs of the ordinary man and woman, tied up in red tape. And when you go in there, you've got to, your feeling is, well, you know the old saying, how can you fight City Hall? The Greek citizens took full charge of all the business of their state and controlled its operations. However, this democracy was limited to the small city-state and was not extended to others. Dependent communities were not incorporated into the Athenian Republic, as, say, Hawaii and Alaska have been incorporated into the United States on an equal rights basis. They were annexed as subjects. Athenian democracy has been well characterized by Will Durant in his book, The Life of Greece, as the narrowest and fullest in history. Narrowness in the number of those who share its privileges, fullest in the directness and equality with which all the citizens control legislation and administer public affairs. Having given you a picture of Greek democracy, I want to now discuss a question which some people find extremely puzzling and even insoluble. And that is the relations between dictatorship and democracy. In common sense thought, especially in our own country, democracy is believed to be one thing, dictatorship is another thing, and never the twain shall meet. The two are purely and simply opposite poles of political organization. The truth is not so simple. The truth is rarely pure and never simple. In real history, the relations between democracy and dictatorship have been far more complex and much more combined. I've already pointed out that the autocracy of the tyrants paved the way for democracy in Greece by breaking up the old political and social order. The tyranny was one of the preconditions for the advent of democracy. But that was only the beginning in the historical evolution. If you take the Democratic Republic of the Greek city-states in and of itself, it operated as a dictatorship. It was the domination of a minority of citizens who alone exercised political rights over the non-citizens, and they were a majority, the women, the slaves, and the foreigners. And even within the boundaries of that democratic citizen body, it was the wealthier elements that predominated, who dictated in the last analysis. So we see that in political actuality, a democracy can contain dictatorial forces and features within itself. Well, then, someone who thinks in simple, commonplace categories will rise up and wave their finger and say, but aren't democracy and dictatorship opposites? Yes, they're opposites. But opposites interpenetrate each other. They combine. And that's what happened in Greek democracy. And I was trying to show and explain in every political democracy today. You had the political form of democratic sovereignty, together with the social economic dictatorship of a minority, and they coexisted in a dialectical interrelationship and interaction. And this has been a constant and common characteristic of all the democratic states in class society. If you don't understand this about them, you don't understand their essence, their foundation. You have a superficial, a one-sided view of political democracy. Now, this will emerge more clearly as the subsequent course of democracy in Western Europe is delineated. The successive stages of democracy fall into three main types, and here I'll give you a preview of the next four talks. Ancient democracy as in Greece, bourgeois democracy as in Holland, England, and the United States, and finally, workers' democracy as it is realized or restricted in the workers' states of our own century. And in all these historical forms of political democracy, there has been a dictatorship of a ruling class. Ancient democracy was the dictatorship of slaveholders. That can be proved. Bourgeois democracy has been and remains the social dictatorship of capitalist proprietors. I hope to dwell on that in a subsequent talk and go into detail about it and show just how and why. Socialist democracy is a dictatorship of the working people. However, there are two basic differences between the forms of democracy based upon the private ownership of the means of production and workers' democracy. Previous forms of democracy from Greece to capitalist times have been based upon exploitative economic relations, which gave political supremacy to owners of the means of production. Workers' democracies are based upon relations of production which are not exploitative in character. Now I want to sum up so that you can see the whole thing in global form. And I'll do that in the form of seven propositions. One, the first democracies in the Western world were the political products of a social structure arising out of the transition from the old agricultural order to the new economy, characterized by elementary commodity production for the market, far-flung trade, private ownership of land, metal money, the mortgage system, and slave labor. Two, these democratic regimes were the result of the fierce class conflicts and political revolutions engendered by these new economic conditions. Three, the democratic republics were essentially a form of rule instituted by the urban middle classes and their plebeian allies. Four, these ancient democracies were limited in extent and in depth. They were confined to the small city-states bordering the Mediterranean and involved only a minority of the population. Five, they turned out to be unstable and short-lived in the ancient world. The era of democracy among the Greek independent city-states lasted for no more than 200 years, from the 6th to the 4th centuries BC. That's all. Even the most full-blooded democracies were liable to be overthrown every now and then by conspiracies of the oligarchs or tyrants. Miletus, Corinth, Athens, and other prominent commercial centers experienced considerable and continual fluctuations of political rulership during the heydays of their democracies. The Greek democracies decayed and collapsed when the historical conditions which enabled them to exist and to flourish passed away. It was really an exceptional combination of historical conditions which brought them into being. Their narrow bases were undermined by slavery from within and invasion from without. The city-states fell an easy victim to the Macedonian, Alexandrian, and Roman conquerors who subjected them to a new type of imperial monarchy. In expiring, this first experiment in political democracy, for that was what it was, could not give birth directly to a higher type of democracy. The next major development along this line had to wait 1,800 years until the new bourgeois society in Western Europe brought forth the necessary economic relations, social forces, and revolutionary mass political movements into being. And these we'll undertake to consider next time. Well, now we'll open for any questions that you might have or comments you might care to make. Yes.
it's been stated that there was unnecessary and implied a causal relationship between the existence of slavery and the ability for democracy to exist in Athens. Could you speak to that?
The question is, what was the necessary relationship between slavery in Athens and its democracy? It is not true that slavery in and of itself is a necessary foundation or the an element in the birth process of democracy. As a matter of fact, slavery, organically and necessary, is rather more naturally capped or coexisting with some sort of a dictatorial form of government, because to keep people in enslavement requires a very formidable apparatus of force. And it's an anomaly to have a foundation of slave production together with a democratic form of government. That was the great paradox of the Cotton Kingdom. And eventually that paradox had to be resolved. Might also add it's the paradox of the United States of America and the so-called free world too. But I won't go into that now, I'll go into that later. However, it is a fact that slavery was a fundamental element of the most progressive Greek city-states. Now, we must remember that this slavery, in the first place, had certain special characteristics. Unlike Rome, where slavery flourished equally, slavery was, for the most part, concentrated in the cities and not in the countrysides on huge plantations. They called them latifundia. In the country districts, slaves were rather sparsely aggregated, except in a few of the mines of Athens. The silver mines of Athens were operated by slaves. In the second place, except for the mines and the galleys, slavery had a was not quite so fierce and repressive in Athens as it was in let us say, our own southern states, which had a system of commercialized chattel slavery tied up with the world capitalist system. There was an easier relationship between the masters and slaves, and it was possible for the slaves to become emancipated. And a goodly number of slaves were emancipated. Moreover, slavery was not necessarily hereditary. A great many of the slaves were war captives. And at that time, it was generally accepted that one of the fortunes of war were, if you were conquered, the conquered peoples would pass under the into the status of slavery, and then if you conquered the other people in turn, you would enslave them. So that slavery was not an eternal and predestined fate. Yeah. The third factor was the low level of technology and of production. At that time, the keenest minds could not conceive of there being a wealthy, free, and cultured city or society without bondage on the part of a large section of its people, who would produce the means of wealth for the leisure class, who would govern, who would engage in thinking, in the arts, and the arts of living. If you will read Aristotle or Plato or others, he came to grips very honestly with this problem. One of the Greek writers says, if spinning wheels could spin of themselves and mills could operate by themselves, we would have no need of slaves. And that would be a good thing. Mankind would be happy. But you see, they had not reached the age of the triple revolution or automation. And at that stage of technology, it did require the mass of working people to produce the sustenance and the goods of society, but not enough to give everyone a sufficient abundance so that they could have a great deal of leisure time as well. And that is why, no matter what the wishes of the peoples of that time, any civilized society would begin to differentiate and divide into classes. This was not wished by anybody. It was an automatic process which developed behind people's back. And the form in which that took in the Mediterranean was the enslavement of one section of the population by another. So that you could not really have a progressive, cultured, and civilized society at that time without some form of class domination. And that has by and large remained true to this very day, so that all the accomplishments of classical antiquity, from philosophy, geometry, democracy, astronomy, you name it, were tainted by the stigma of slavery and class rule, and eventually it undermined the best of their institutions and achievements and led to their undoing. Yes.
I'd like you spoke about the fact that democracy, I think you did, said that democracy and the dictatorship could exist concurrently and in the same society. And I was wondering, could you clarify that point a little bit more in reference to the United States and show me or explain for me how a dictatorship in the United States can exist concurrently with democracy, and what are the forces within such a society which can compel and can create a dictatorship concurrently with a democracy?
That's going to be the topic of my fourth talk. I'll devote the whole talk to it. So let's defer it until then. I'd like to treat it adequately.
Okay.
There is a, what you have is a combination of a political democracy with a social dictatorship of a minority in a fusion. One relates to the economic foundations and the other relates to its form of political organization. I can only give you this general formula, but I don't want to go into concrete details because that'll steal the thunder from my fourth talk, where I will try to develop develop this point consistently and show both sides of it, both the democratic features and the dictatorial, in fusion with each other.
Could you answer this question for me? During the Civil War, the South, as a result of the Civil War, when the Civil War started, the South emerged with a highly organized an efficient army, and the North had to build its army. Did the existence, is there some relationship between this army, the control of slaves in the South, and the dictatorship you spoke about?
Yes, a very direct relationship. The United States, after the founding of the Republic from 1789 to 1860, was ruled by an alliance, a combination of the southern slaveholding planters and the northern businessmen of different degrees. The southern planters, being rooted in large-scale agriculture, were like the Spartans as compared to the Athenians. They were, although they used to compare, that they consider themselves modern Athenians. If you've read some of the pre-Civil War literature, their ideologists used to say, well, we're the slave Democrats of the 19th century with all our glorious culture, just like the Athenians were in the 5th century BC. But they were really more like the Spartans, not like the Athenians, because the Spartans were retrogressive, backward, and so were the southern slaveholders considered, compared with the North or with Europe. As a leisured, parasitic ruling group, they had all the accoutrements, the attributes, the customs of that type of rural gentry. Now, what does the rural gentry decide to do with itself and its sons? In England, they used to say, the elder son will inherit the estate. The next son will go into the army, and the third will go into the church. What was